at a time.
Welcome to America Tonight with me, Kate Delaney. Hey, everybody. How are you doing out in those nooks and crannies? I'm in a big nook right now. The Emerald Isle. Yes, the birthplace of my ancestors way back when. The ones that weren't killed by Henry VIII, anyway. Yep, we're hanging out here. Kate Delaney with some guests that are coming in here at Clontarf. It's great. The castle. I'm going to call it the castle. It's a hotel, but I'm going to feel like I'm in the 14th century in the castle. It makes me feel good. It's pretty cool to be out here, and we're very excited, and the people of Ireland have been so hospitable. It could not be, they could not be friendlier. Sitting with us right now is Lisa Hand, and she's a political writer for The Independent, and we were talking off the mic, and Lisa had a chance to come to the United States the last time around in the election cycle when, of course, you had Obama versus McCain and the whole Sarah Palin drama and whatnot. It was wild what happened in that election. She had the chance to go to both conventions. And what did you, and first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And what did you notice? What were your impressions of our politics when you got to be at both conventions that were so huge, by the way?
Well, I mean, I got very lucky going to those two particular conventions, obviously, because it was an extraordinary election. But I think what struck me immediately was the enormous razzmatazz around American politics, which we don't really have here. It tends to be a bit low-key, and we sort of frown on a lot of the sort of razzmatazz and the jazz and the balloons and the kind of talking yourself up. You know, we tend to do things much on a much more modest scale here. So I found it, the coordination absolutely fascinating, the choreography of the speeches and the guests and just the whole drama of the thing. I mean, obviously, the sort of introduction of Sarah Palin while I was there was quite extraordinary. Actually, I was on a flight between the two conventions when the whole plane was just full of American reporters, and the pilot comes on and says, "Oh, anybody who might be interested, they've just announced Sarah Palin as the vice presidential pick." Now, I don't know what you can imagine being 35,000 feet in the air with a whole plane full of American political reporters who have no access to any information whatsoever. So you just had a whole plane load of people going completely crazy to find out what was going on back on the ground. I mean, I really didn't know what was going to happen. So I love the intensity, the frenzy, the enormous buzz and the energy and the excitement around it. I was completely fascinated.
Yeah, and you saw, too, from both perspectives, the first time around for Obama and all the storylines that were associated with that. Do you think, and because you know your audience, as you said, it's much different when it comes to Irish politics, but do you feel that you're fascinated by it because you're a political junkie, but what about the rest of Ireland? Are people talking about it? I've had people ask me, that's why I asked that. Are people fascinated by second time around for Obama? Geez, we have debates going on. Are they interested in that?
Well, they really are. I mean, I think Irish people have had a fascination with American politics, I mean, forever. I suppose particularly since John F. Kennedy. You know, he was the first American president to come to Ireland to trace his roots, which were down in County Wexford. But I think every American president, Gerald Ford, I think, actually has Irish roots. Some of them are much more tenuous than others. But, I mean, even Richard Nixon went to County Kildare, you know, to discover his Irish roots. Actually, I think he called his dog Timahoe after the town that his family were from, you know. And then, obviously, you have, you know, Bill Clinton and all his enormous connections with Ireland. In fact, he fetched up somewhere in the States last week, claiming he could actually run for president of Ireland because of his Irish roots. So people were kind of fascinated by that. And he's more than welcome, actually. If he wants to come over and throw his hat into the presidential ring, we'd be delighted, and I'd be delighted to cover it. But there is a genuine fascination. I think it's obviously the connection between the two countries, just in terms of, you know, there are at least, you know, 35 million people who claim to be Irish American, who are Irish American, and we feel a deep connection with the country, and we care very much about, you know, how the politics happens over there, because obviously what happens in America, you know, impacts enormously on us here as well.
Tell us about, because, you know, many of the people that are listening have no idea about Irish politics. The North, the South, things that have happened in the past. I just went up to Belfast a couple of days ago. Explain how politics work here.
Well, Ireland is it's a 32 county, which is, you know, our mini version of states. The six counties belong to Northern Ireland, and they have now have their own parliament. You know, we've had our difficulties and troubles here. But thanks to a peace agreement, you know, we now have a very stable and peaceful situation here. And the six counties have their own parliament. They're still connected to Westminster in Britain, but their politicians are now elected, and they come from both sides of the community, both the Catholic and the Protestant. And, you know, they rub along okay. You know, it's the peace process is always an evolving thing, and, you know, you get setbacks and so on. But I think everybody is just so happy just the way that, you know, harmony has actually broken out between them. Now, in the Republic, which is the 26 counties, we have a two-house parliament, we have a Senate, which we call a Seanad, and we have then the lower house, which we call the Dáil. We have 166 politicians representing the whole country. There are three main parties in Ireland. We love coalition governments over here. We're very fond of them. We've always had them since the foundation of the state, because I think Irish people have an innate suspicion of politicians and don't like to let one party loose just to, you know, with the keys to the safe, which is, well, hey, pretty empty at the moment. But so we like coalition governments, and at the moment we have a coalition between the largest party, which is Fine Gael, which would be centre-right, and the Labour Party, which would be centre-left. The last election, a bit like the last election in the US, we had an absolutely game-changing election, which saw the hitherto then largest party in the state, which was Fianna Fáil, get completely and utterly annihilated. They were swept away. They lost over 50 seats. Oh, I mean, the entire country blamed them for the financial mess and the chaos that we ended up in, because, you know, we had a great here. We had an amazing economy. Everything was going well. You know, we had our Celtic Tiger, and everybody had money in their pockets, and we used to go to New York and shop for the weekends. You know, we had a great time. Then, of course, it all went horribly, horribly wrong, and a lot of people did blame the policies of the last government, which is led by this big party. So, oh my God, I mean, there was blood on the floor of the polling booths here. You know, it was an extraordinary election. And, you know, Irish politics is very interesting to cover and very volatile. There's always, you know, rows. You know, with any coalition, it's a bit like kind of, you know, they're like a shotgun marriage, really. You know, you can often have, you know, two people really not suited to each other, you know, but they have to get into the political bed together, you know. And, you know, that'll always end up with interesting, you know, sort of interesting scenarios.
We only have a couple minutes left, but sure. As from the journalist's perspective, it's interesting. Do you have good, with that kind of a setup, do you have good access to the politicians, or are they tight-lipped? Because Irish tend to have the gift of the gab, and then do you have to really work those sources, or are they pretty free with information?
That's a great question, actually, because we have, as a pack of political journalists, we have enormous access to our politicians, unprecedented. It always amuses me when I see, you know, American journalists and the hoops they have to go to get near, you know, particularly the president. I mean, the other day I was in our parliament, you know, this sounds kind of a boast, but this is just what happens, and I was just going to sit down, have a cup of tea in the kind of public canteen, and there's our prime minister, called our Taoiseach, who's Enda Kenny, who is a very, very friendly guy. He's from the west of Ireland. And he just says, hey, sit down and have a coffee. Now, you know, no security, no nothing, no handlers, no spin doctors, no nothing. So we sit down and we chew the fat for 15 minutes. So, you know, yeah, get to the gab. We have it.
You have it. You got access. You were tremendous. We'd love to have you back on the show. Will you come back on again?
I would love to.
All right, Lisa Hand, we can't wait to have her back on. We're gonna pick this lady's brain a few more times if she lets us. We'll be back with more here from Dublin. Hang with us.
Let's keep preparedness simple. Do you need stuff for disasters? Of course you do. For over 15 years, DisasterStuff.com has, well, stuff for disasters. See? Easy to remember. DisasterStuff.com. Want free shipping on a new Berkey water filter? DisasterStuff.com is the official Berkey in-stock shipping center. Lots of folks want an EMP Faraday bag to protect sensitive electronics during a solar or nuclear event. Now for a limited time, all survival gear purchases over $75 include a free 8x8-inch EMP Faraday bag. Just enter promo code EMPBAG when you check out at DisasterStuff.com. We're also a Country Living Grain Mill authorized dealer. Plus, we offer freeze-dried foods by Alpine Air and Wise Foods. We also carry emergency kits, survival seeds, and much more. Preparedness should be simple, and it is. Just remember, DisasterStuff.com. Freedom through self-reliance and personal responsibility.
What's going on with food prices? Have you noticed how your favorite ice cream is now 14 ounces instead of a pint? Round-trip airfares into 9 major cities has increased 44% in just 1 year. Ask your 18 to 25-year-old what it costs to buy some nice, fashionable jeans. $300? And yet not one person in 100 realizes these prices reflect government spending and Federal Reserve Bank dollar printing. Gold in the last 10 years has increased 450%, while the dollar's purchasing power is declining daily. My name is Daniel Larson. I work at Midas Resources. To learn more about how gold and silver can protect your dwindling purchasing power and your IRA accounts, call 1-800-686-2237, extension 134. That's 800-686-2237, extension 134. Daniel Larson, 800-686-2237, extension 134.
Healthy soils grow healthy plants. So before you plant your survival garden this year, is your soil healthy? Maximize your crisis garden soil with EM1 from Terraganics. EM1 Organic Soil Conditioner, Fertilizer Amendment, and Compost Accelerant provides healthier gardens and faster, efficient garden composting. EM1 from Terraganics.com quickly improves soil structure by increasing nutrient availability and converting organic matter into soil humus. This improves seed germination and root growth, improves plant quality, size, color, flavor, nutrient value of fruits and vegetables, and improves shelf life. And when rain is not in the forecast, no worries. EM1 improves moisture retention in soils, helping reduce drought stress. Just like you prepare all else, prepare your crisis garden for maximum yields with EM1 from Terraganics.com. Order now at Terraganics.com or call toll-free 866-369-3678. That's 866-369-3678. Terraganics. Life's getting better.
I heat up, I can't cool down. Got me spinning round and round.
Welcome back to America Tonight, and of course we're broadcasting live from Dublin, Ireland. Before me now is going to be my new best friend, because I'm such a Dracula hound. Denny McIntyre is here from Stoker is who we're talking about. And of course the connection to Ireland is huge. Just down the street is where Brom grew up, and I had no idea. I guess because I know more about the book itself and about the character and all the alliterations over the years and things that have happened, but I never really delved into his background. So this is fascinating for us. Denny, thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Great to be here.
And we're going to have you just belly up to the microphone. There you go. You know, like belly up to the bar. You just have to make that your new best friend.
In Ireland, yeah.
Exactly. So tell us about Brom growing up. What would have growing up been like for him? And was he born in Ireland?
Brom was born literally a kick of a football from where you were sitting this minute, in a lovely little Georgian street in Clontarf, Dublin, called The Crescent.
Mm.
Now, he had a strange childhood. Bram didn't walk until he was 7 years old. Now, we never did find out why. We don't know whether it's psychological or physical or a bit of both. And during that time, he was given up for dead several times. He baffled doctors by resurrecting himself. Indeed, people say in later life, he could have been his own role model for Dracula. The only one who stood by him in those days was his mother, as mothers do. And she told him little stories to keep him going. And eventually, he put it behind him, whatever it was that enfeebled him. He grew up to be a big man. He turned the tables. He's a great role model for children who might not feel adequate. He went to Trinity College, the great college right in the middle of Dublin. And when I say turned the tables, from a child who couldn't walk, he became a top-class sportsman. And he won medals in walking, running, swimming, weightlifting, and played rugby at a very high level.
Wow.
He then, just to finish a thumbnail sketch of his life, he then did his degree in Trinity. He went and became a civil servant, following in his father's footsteps in the old imperial civil service, we were still a colony of Britain, in Dublin Castle. Didn't like it. It wasn't his life. And during that time, he himself said he wrote perhaps one of the most boring books ever written. It was called The Duties of Petty Clerks in the Civil Service. In other words, a Civil Service rule book. And I don't think he'd be going out rushing out to buy that particular one.
No.
Anyways, he was bored of this job, and he turned to writing and to drama. And this was to change his life forever. He started going in Dublin to the old theatres. People who don't know Dublin at the time, there was a famous Theatre Royal and the Queen's, and one that's still there, right in the middle of Dublin, called the Gaiety Theatre. If you're in there, it's on South King Street. And he came across a famous English actor called Henry Irving. Now, Irving turned out to be the Laurence Olivier of his day. He came to Dublin with touring groups, and Bram saw him in action. And Bram wrote articles praising this Henry Irving. The upshot was that Irving met Stoker in the Shelburne Hotel, a famous hotel right in the middle of Dublin, because Irving was a bit of a snob. He wouldn't stay in the lesser places. And the upshot was that he asked Bram to become his manager and to manage the theatre he owned in London called the Lyceum, a world famous theatre.
Mm-hmm.
And Bram accepted. And in 1 week in late 1878, Bram gave up his civil service job, moved to England, got married, of course, first. That's very important. He married a beautiful local girl called Florence Balcom. She lived on the Crescent as well, so he didn't go very far for a wife, if you like. And not alone that, but she had been courted by a certain Oscar Wilde. Now, that name should ring a bell with
a lot of people. Yes, absolutely, in America.
So you might say, well, look what she missed, but that's another story. In any case, they got married, and he stayed with Irving for all of 27 years until Irving died. Now, during that time, and this is a part I'm sure Americans would like to know, they took on tours of America. Now, this was pioneering stuff. Between 1883 and 1903, in a 20-year spell, the toured America, the Lyceum Players did, 8 times. Now, touring America didn't mean you went to Heathrow Airport in London and flew to Kennedy in America. There was no Heathrow and there was no Kennedy. They booked 2 to 3 carriages of a train from London to Liverpool. Now, they brought everything bar the stage. They brought the props, the sets, 100 actors, wig makers even. You
wow.
know they brought it. And they crisscrossed, they spent maybe 2 to 3 months getting to New York. They crisscrossed a young America from New York to San Francisco and from Mexico to Canada. They missed no major city. And in 8 tours, Bram estimated they travelled the equivalent of twice around the globe, about 50,000 miles. They never missed a performance. Now, Bram himself loved America. You see, Irving kind of used him as his, well, I wouldn't say a slave, but certainly a lesser being. Irving would swan off with his cigar and his gin and tonic and so on, while Bram did the hard work. But Bram was hobnobbing it with the biggies. And in America, he met people like Walt Whitman. He met Mark Twain. He met Buffalo Bill. He met Theodore Roosevelt. So he didn't mind being kind of used because he had his tall hat and his tail coat and he felt all important. Now, Whitman is important because at the time, Whitman, as you may know, wrote very controversial poetry in the, you know, homosexual, that type of stuff.
Right.
Which at the time was taboo.
Oh, yeah.
Now, before Bram ever left Dublin, he sent letters of support to Whitman. Whitman would be kind of an older generation. And Whitman was shunned for a while in America. Now he's an icon. So Bram loved his tours of America, and they made a lot of money there as well. The end of Bram's life came when, as I said, Irving died in 1906. Bram himself got a stroke. He missed his old pal, if you like. And he wrote on for another 6 years, and it's easy to remember when he actually died, because he died the same week as the Titanic went down. The Titanic sank on the night of the 14th, 15th of April, 1912, and Bram died on the 20th. And we often say about Bram that he was somewhat unlucky in life. He was overshadowed by Irving, his manager and boss and the great actor. He was overshadowed by his own creation, Dracula. And even in death, he was eclipsed by the Titanic sinking. So it's a most, most interesting life story. Now, of course, the big one is Dracula.
Yeah, you know. Dracula. How did he come up with the inspiration for Dracula?
Well, a wonderful, wonderful question, because this is one we're debating and arguing at the moment. And I myself, I'm almost finished a book claiming the Irishness of Dracula. Up to now, people who have heard the word Dracula and read the book of it, they say, well, that's based on Vlad the Impaler in Romania, or Transylvania, part of Romania. Nothing could be further from the truth. This man was never outside Dublin until he was 31 years of age. He was never in Romania or Transylvania in his life. And although he did immigrate and become Irving's manager, and wrote the book when he was abroad, there's no doubt about it, the genesis of it was in his mind long before he left Dublin. And I always argue that a writer, and I write into it myself, mm-hmm. go back to where you're safe, to your roots. And that was in his childhood, growing up days in Ireland. And in fact, if you read the book properly, nobody except somebody who lived in Ireland in the 19th century could write such a book. Now, start with the name. Dracula, I say, comes from the old Gaelic word Drach Ulla. Drach means bad, and Ulla is blood. Drach Ulla, bad blood. I mentioned earlier that he was sickly as a child.
Yes.
And his mother told him stories. Now, she was from the west of Ireland, in a place called Sligo. And one story she told him was of a famous cholera epidemic in the year 1832, where if you contracted this disease, there really was no cure. And when you were advanced with the disease, nobody would come near you or touch you. And she saw big pits or graves being dug, and bodies, while they were still alive, being pushed in, not by hand, but by use of long wooden poles. And they were literally buried alive. Now, the point is this. Did Bram get the idea of the undead? Because he brings that word into common usage, the undead. He says a vampire is dead during the day, but alive by night. Did it come from these people who were treated in such a way that they came back as vampires to wreak revenge on mankind for the way they were treated? I'll give you another quick one or two. Ireland was very, very political in our relationship with Britain for so many years. Now, during Bram's time, Bram was born in a very famous year, the 1847, the height of a terrible, what I call a Holocaust in Ireland, which was the Great Famine.
Mm-hmm.
So he grew up a famine child. Now we say, metaphorically speaking, was this creature, this creation, Dracula, the landlord up in his big house, sucking the blood of the people? It could be the British lion sucking the Irish blood.
Right.
Here in Dublin, if you have time, you should go down to the very famous church down along the quays in a street called Church Street, not far from the city centre. And by some atmospheric freak, that church is built in a bogland or whatever, and the temperature remains constant. And bodies buried in the vaults of that church have remained intact. They haven't decayed. They're like mummified bodies.
Hold that thought. The mummified bodies, Church Street. Can you hang around for a few more minutes? All right, excellent. We're going to talk to Denny. Somebody's got to get him a cup of coffee. This is great stuff. Dracula. I mean, this is amazing. Bram, all the inside scoop. Hang with us. We're live in Dublin. Stay with us.
Fight back this cold and flu season with the world's best garlic extract, Ally C. Why Ally C? Because it helps your body fight viruses, bacteria, and fungi. Ally C has been scientifically proven in double-blind studies using low doses to greatly reduce the number, severity, and duration of common colds. Ally C contains 300 milligrams of stabilized allicin, the active ingredient in crushed garlic. Studies show Ally C is effective against MRSA, bacterial, fungal, and viral infections. One tablet of Ally C has the equivalent of 40 cloves of garlic. Ally C supports your body's resistance to all types of conditions and can help lower high blood pressure and high cholesterol. So boost your body's resistance to infection with nature's best garlic extract, Ally C. For more information and to order Ally C, call 877-888-7126 or go to garlichhealthproducts.com. That's 1-877-888-7126 or go to garlichhealthproducts.com for your Ally C today.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN. Great talk radio starts here.
My name is Gary Johnson. Today I reach out to you, members of all political parties. I reach out to everyone with a vote and an axe to grind. I ask you to join me in trying something that's never been attempted before in America. Let's put our parties and our differences aside one time. Be libertarian with me for one election. Together, we'll stop the spending and end the wars. Together, we'll rebuild our own roads, bridges, schools, and hospitals instead of building theirs half a world away. Together, we'll restore our industrial might and our economy. And if in 4 years we as a people decide we don't like peace, prosperity, and freedom, we can always vote failure back into office again. We the people live free.
Gary Johnson, Libertarian for President.
Paid for by Gary Johnson, 2012.
Iodine protection packs from hempusa.org are now in stock for immediate delivery worldwide. Our iodine protection packs include microplant powder, green life kelp, red palm oil, and our clear roll-on iodine that will feed the body the iodine it needs. All iodine protection packs are in stock, save you money, and ship for free in all 50 states. Visit hempusa.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
HempUSA.org has a revolutionary wonder food for detoxing the body and rebuilding the immune system.
Microplant powder can help unclog arteries and soften heart valves while removing heavy metals, virus, fungus, bacteria, and parasites. Plus, it cleans and purifies the blood, lungs, stomach, and colon. Keep your body clean with microplant powder. Visit us at HempUSA.org or call 908-691-2608 today.
Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. Amino acids have to be delivered to your body in the shape that nature gave them if they are to be used to create new proteins in your body. Just like a bricklayer cannot use bent or twisted bricks to build a brick wall, so too your body cannot use bent or twisted amino acids to build new proteins. Giving your body an undamaged amino acid food can make a huge difference in your health. One World Way is an undamaged amino acid food unlike any other. You see, heating bends and twists amino acids, and all whey protein powders we've investigated, and most proteins you consume, are heated. With our TruCool process, you now have a choice with One World Way.
My name is Daniel. I'm 34 years old. When I started using One World Way, I weighed 228 pounds. Now, after 2.5 months, I weigh 182 pounds. This is my ideal weight. I've noticed an increase in stamina, rate of recovery from workouts, and an increase in my potency.
Call 888-988-3325 or visit oneworldway.com.
I'm in Dublin. I'm with Denny McIntyre, and I'm talking about blood and Dracula and steaks and Bram Stoker. You have no idea, Denny. When I was a kid, I don't know what it was. My father died when I was young, when I was 7, but the thing I remember about him is he knew I liked scary, or maybe he taught me to like scary, and he taught me about Dracula, which seems odd, right? When other little girls were reading about nice things and nursery rhymes and whatever, I was learning about fangs and steaks. Now, he was a writer, so maybe there's something to that. I don't know. But I used to taunt my little brother because he was afraid of the whole Dracula thing. So as a child, I was always fascinated by it. And how did the story come about? And that's what we're talking about now. You were in the middle of telling us about the church on O'Connell, right? And talking about
the mummified bodies.
The mummified bodies, thank you. And how that might have been the correlation, the part of the story of Dracula, and what do you make of the fact that the bodies, like you said, the temperature is constant.
Yes, it's a freak. It's a freak. It's built in peatland, so these bodies don't decay. They're preserved as a natural mummification. Now we know that the Stoker family, Bram's ancestors, had a burial vault there, had and have a burial vault there. And Bram, as a child, used to visit that site regularly and spend hours playing there. Now, the point being, did he get the idea of these mummified bodies not being dead, as he called it, undead, and they came out at midnight in the dark or whatever, to live on the blood of that they were vampires. They never died, and sucked the blood of the living, and maybe that's part of the creation of the vampire. Now, I'll talk for a moment about suicide in Ireland, because, again, you notice all these stories have to do with resurrection and coming back and giving blood, and all these were deep, deep themes in Ireland, going back to the famine. You know, people lived off the blood of the milch cow sometimes and that. Now, in Bram Stoker's day, and indeed to this day in Ireland, many people have a stigma about suicide. And people regarded suicide victims as people who essentially cut themselves off from the love of mankind and shoved themselves out into the wilderness, unwanted and unloved, which essentially is what a vampire is. Now, these people weren't allowed to be buried. Their bodies weren't allowed to be buried in consecrated ground. They were buried with unbaptized infants and barbaric practices like that. And they were buried in what were called suicide plots.
Mm.
Now, it so happened there was one of these plots right beside Bram Stoker's house, just down the road from where we are in Clontarf. And again, like the mummified bodies in St. Vicens, Bram was known to spend hours playing in this graveyard. Now, anybody who committed suicide was regarded as becoming a vampire unless they got the stake through the heart treatment before they were buried. In other words, you had to have the stake punched right through the heart to expel any evil spirit within you or whatever. Now, when he was playing in this graveyard, he had a great imagination. Did he imagine one or more of these people being buried without the stake through the heart treatment and therefore came back roaming the earth as vampires and wrecking their own havoc and sucking on the blood of the living too for sustenance? So, you know, all these influences were within his radius of where he lived.
Right, so you would assume it's interesting that why saying Transylvania and claiming Transylvania, it does seem from all the pieces that you put together here, it seems pretty obvious that he would have the makings of Dracula in his own neighborhood.
Indeed he had, and I'll just add another one. There are many, but the first novel he wrote, now, as I said, he wrote, I told you, the boring book of the civil service of that, with apologies to civil servants. The first novel he wrote was called The Snake's Pass, and it's set in the west of Ireland. This has to do with what was known in Ireland as the Gombeen Man. The Gombeen Man was a moneylender. And once the moneylender got his sort of claws on you, he would not let go. He'd lend you so much money, but when you were nearly finished paying it back, he didn't let you finish the loan. He lent you more, and you got deeper and deeper into the mire.
Mm.
And then he wanted not just the loan. He took whatever property you had. Now, we say, is the vampire one further step from the Gombeen Man, that he wanted your very life's blood as well as your property? And, you know, as if Bram never had to go beyond
his own
zone of existence in Ireland.
Exactly. And you mentioned this. He had the pretty wife. He stole the pretty wife from Oscar Wilde. So that was a good thing. And you said that there was some significance to Florence. What's the significance of Florence?
Florence, by the way, when she was dating Oscar, and I think she was a little bit of a two-timer, to be honest. But she eventually probably opted for Oscar, for Bram, in the sense that Bram was 32, Oscar was 22, and she was 19. Now, she probably plumped for the more mature Bram, who at the time was in a settled civil service job, and no doubt her parents would have kind of maybe urged her to marry the more secure, because Oscar was still going around with a cigar and his uttering witticisms with no real future.
Right.
So that perhaps swayed her. He didn't take it well, and he had given her a little cross, inscribed cross, for Christmas. And he wrote to her, and he wanted to meet her for one last time. And he wanted the cross back, and to be given back to him only in her mother's house, because that's where he first met her, apparently. Ironically, it was Oscar introduced Bram to Florence in the first place. So he got the cross back, and he told her, I'm immigrating. So he went to London and was in high society for a while, and then his downfall was dreadful and sudden.
Yeah.
Florence and Bram, they, you know, they were married under a very beautiful church in Dawson Street, another place you should visit if you have time, a very, very beautiful church, and an atmospheric church, in November 1878. Now, Florence herself, they looked an unusual couple. He was a big, burly, strong man, and she was tall but very effeminate. And Dave wanted to get out of Dublin. Not just that he was bored with his job in the civil service. She had ideas of becoming maybe an actress herself. And Dublin at the time, it had been the second city of the British Empire. But after the Act of Union, which people might remember as an act that bound Ireland to Britain and got rid of the Irish Parliament, after that, high society left Dublin. We had no MPs here. We had no reveal of the absentee landlord. So there was no upper class, you know, dazzling society in Dublin. And when boring place, far people at that level, indeed the Stokers and the Wild would be high society at the time. So anyways, they were glad to go to London. Now, Florence had, they had one son, Noel.
Mm-hmm.
And just to finish the line, Noel then had one daughter, Anne, who only died in the 1990s. And she married twice. She had three sons, who we know very well to this day. They come over and back to Dublin. Florence seems to have been the perfect wife, though. Although after Noel was born, I think, shall we say, physical relations or conjugal relations ceased at that stage. I don't think she liked being pregnant. And there was going to be no more of that type of thing. But apparently they were the perfect host couple with the, you know, the sorries and the garden parties and all the rest of it in Chelsea, in and around the Chelsea area of London. And she didn't travel much with them, especially on the American tours, for the simple reason she didn't like Irving. Because she thought he used Bram, which he did, there's no doubt about that.
Right.
But she lived to be an old lady. Vincent Price, the actor, met her before she died, and he said she was an elderly lady. She was in her 90s, and her eyes were almost closed with cataracts. But there was no doubt about it, they loved each other. There's little question of that. And,
right.
She had a happy life, and, you know, as women do, she won in the end anyway, because Bram's, people often ask, did the book make much money? Now, while he was alive, it was published originally in 1897, this is Dracula.
Right.
And while he was alive, it was a good seller without being a bestseller. He died, as we know, in the 1912, but it wasn't until the movie started. And the first one was Nosferatu. Well, that was a pirated version. But 1930, Universal Studios purchased the rights to the book and made the first talkie film. And Florence had sold the rights to this, something like, I don't know the exact sum, but it was a huge amount. And from then on, they never looked back, so she lived comfortably. And on the royalties and ever since, they have bought a number of houses around London and the Isle of Wight and places like that. So, and talking about royalties, Bram's son, Noel, was very funny. In Bram's day, you know, copyright ran out 50 years after you died. It's now 75 years.
Right.
But watch the dates. Bram died in 1912. His son, Noel, died in 1962. 50 years to the day, almost. And on his deathbed, Noel is supposed to have said, well, fair play to old dad. He kept me going to the very end.
With the royalties.
I
love that.
Which was uncanny, you know.
We only have a few minutes left, but, Denny, if people came to Ireland, what can they see? Because you were talking about this, that you weren't getting much help initially at all, really. Why isn't this a bigger story for Ireland? Because it's huge.
Well, I was very briefly, before I go into what you can do, very briefly, people often ask me, why is this story and this man not better known in Ireland?
Right.
Well, I honestly think one of the main reasons is the fact he doesn't appear in the school curriculum. And that's where you meet all the famous
that's
writers.
Right.
That's where in Ireland we meet Joyce and Yeats and Wilde and the rest of them. Now, I think, and I'm not having a go at anybody, but I think the clergy and maybe those in charge of education over the years were afraid of this subject.
Right.
They thought this creature
Dracula
from the East and vampirized the whole lot of us.
Right.
And
right.
Really challenged society as we know it.
Sure.
Whereas they had nothing to fear. The Dracula story is a good versus evil story.
Sure.
And, you know, good being the vampire hunters and Dracula being evil. And the good wins out over evil because Dracula is killed in the end.
Right.
As good always must win over evil.
Right.
So for that reason alone, I'd ask, we're asking that it be put on the school curriculum. Now, as regards Dublin, anybody visiting Dublin, well, first of all, as a famous singer of ours, head for Clontarf on the seafront bear. We have a Bram Stoker Centre open now, a hotel where you can book in and stay. Now, we do Dracula tours, and we bring you to all the places associated with Bram in Dublin, both here in his native Clontarf and in the city centre, because he went to Trinity College, he worked in Dublin Castle, the Shelburne Hotel where he met Irving, the Gaiety Theatre where he attended shows, and lots of other venues. It's a fascinating story, and, you know, I would beg our tourist association to look more into and help us, lure tourists from America and everywhere
to
else.
To come in.
I guarantee you won't be disappointed with the Stoker story.
Exactly. Denny, you were a delight. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Appreciate it. It was great meeting you.
My pleasure to be here.
Hang with us, everybody. More from Dublin, Ireland. Thank you. Have you ever heard of a pharmacist who discourages the use of most prescription drugs? Well, pharmacist Ben Fuchs is that person, and boy, is he fascinating. He's a nutritional pharmacist and skincare specialist who operates out of Boulder, Colorado. And to hear this man speak is nothing less than inspiring, because he's charismatic and makes a lot of sense. He asks, why take dangerous drugs when all your body needs to stay healthy is all natural with no side effects? Pharmacist Ben sees the human body as a healing and regenerating system, divinely designed to heal and renew itself on a moment-to-moment basis, but it needs nutrition and nutritional supplementation. Ben says you've got to be on a nutritional supplement program if you want to be healthy in 21st century America, and he wants to help people get off the toxic drug treadmill and get on a good nutritional supplement program. I support what pharmacist Ben is saying and doing to help America get healthier, and I urge you to watch and listen to Ben deliver his powerful message at your convenience. Just go to AmericaTonightTeam.com. That's AmericaTonightTeam.com.
If you like cow's milk, you'll love camel milk.
Yes, the newest, oldest thing in the world.
Camel milk has sustained civilizations for thousands of years. Here's just one user's testimonial.
My Lyme-stricken boy developed severe allergies to nearly every food he ingested. At first, I was scared to death to try camel milk, but he had no allergic reactions of any kind, nothing. The camel milk was wondrous in healing his GI issues, and it's the one thing I can attribute to his getting out of bed after almost a year spent there, too ill to do anything.
Camel milk is loaded with health benefits, far superior to other milk, is rich in B vitamins, and 3 times higher in vitamin C than cow's milk, 10 times higher in iron. Camel milk comes fresh or frozen from your trusted local family farm, Humpback Dairies of Miller, Missouri. To order, call this number, 1-417-848-7570. That's 1-417-848-7570. Call 1-417-848-7570 for camel milk, the best kept health secret ever.
If you owe the IRS back taxes, listen carefully. Sweeping changes to IRS policies will help more people than ever eliminate their tax debts once and for all. And now, thanks to Dan Pilla, you can get the tax help you need to end your tax nightmare.
Hi, I'm Dan Pilla. I've helped thousands of people reduce or eliminate tax debts they couldn't pay. And after more than 30 years of experience dealing with the IRS, I can tell you there's no such thing as a hopeless tax case. With the IRS's new policies, it's easier than ever to put your tax debt behind you once and for all. Call now at 800-346-6829 to learn how I can help you. You know your IRS debt will not go away by itself, but you don't have to live in fear anymore. Call 800-346-6829. Learn how I can help you eliminate wage and bank levies, release tax liens, and negotiate a settlement with the IRS that will put your tax nightmare behind you forever. Call 800-34-NO-TAX or go to my website, taxhelponline.com. That's taxhelponline.com.
Welcome back to America Tonight. Kate Delaney hanging out with all of you across this country and beyond the borders. I'm broadcasting from Dublin, Ireland, Clontarf, the old castle, actually now hotel. And it's been very interesting, some of the people that I've met in Ireland and had a chance to speak with. Everybody knows I'm a big sports person. I wrote a book called Level the Playing Field, Balls, Brats, and Other BS. And I used to travel with the Dallas Cowboys, and certainly we talk about sports on this show as we do Nail the Score and whatnot. American football couldn't be bigger. Mark O'Toole is a sports kind of guy. He's a sports journalist. He joins us now. Mark, thanks for coming on America Tonight.
No problem, Kate. Always a good opportunity to talk sport with my friends across the water.
So, American football, what do the Irish think of American football?
Well, it's really blown up over over the past few years here, especially since the advent of we get to see the NFL regularly on Sunday night. So it's the usual thing after a long weekend in Ireland. You take it easy on Sunday night. You don't go out to a pub or anything. And you sit down around 11 o'clock over here, Irish time, and watch a couple of games of NFL. And in fact, even a few weeks back, we had the Emerald Isle Classic, which was obviously an NCAA Division One game between Navy and Notre Dame being played in our National Soccer and Rugby Stadium, which holds a capacity crowd of 50,000. I was there reporting on it for Joe.ie, which is the largest men's media outlet here in Ireland, and it was just a fantastic event. And it wasn't just because we had 30,000 fans of Navy and the Fighting Irish coming over to see the game. It was because there was a lot of Irish people that are pretty much starved year in, year out of seeing live high-class American football coming to see it. So it's really, really respected. It's not kind of a thing, I know, certainly between some of the guys over in England who would obviously trumpet soccer's virtues in comparison to American football. We like all sports over here, and I suppose that was just a fantastic event. It really, it was really great, and what we're really hoping for now in the next few years is obviously Dan Rooney is the ambassador to Ireland, obviously former president of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and he's been lobbying to try and get a an in-season regular game over here in our national Irish sports stadium of Croke Park, which holds 82,000 people. We'd love to see the Pittsburgh Steelers on a regular NFL season game come over like they have in Wembley in England every year. So that's kind of what a lot of Irish fans are crossing their fingers for at the moment.
Let's swing to, and that's interesting, let's swing to Irish sports. We'll watch for those Steelers. Of course, I will tell you, I'm a diehard Philadelphia Eagles fan, just so you know, Mark.
Look, if we can get Philadelphia over against the Pittsburgh Steelers, or if we can get any two franchises that's willing to come over and play, we certainly get a full crowd over in Croke Park.
All right, I love that. The here in Ireland, of course, there was the big All Irish Championships just the other day played, and Kilkenny won, and they are so dominant, beating Galway, and they had come to a draw, and then this was ultimately the final do or die between the two, and I've never seen so many people so excited, but it seemed like everyone was pulling for the underdog. Talk about that match and how significant it is when it comes down to the final two in the Irish Championships.
Absolutely. Well, to put it into context, the All-Ireland hurling final is our equivalent of the Super Bowl every day. It's like waking up for Christmas for sports fans. And Kilkenny are the most dominant side in it. They're possibly the most dominant side we have ever seen in the game of hurling. They've won 34 championships in the 127-year history of the sport in Ireland, in the codified sport in Ireland. It's a bit longer, really. The game of hurling in Ireland is, you know, there's games of it in legends of Cúchulainn, Satanta, going back over 3,000 years ago. So it's a really ancient sport. It was codified in 1884, and this past Sunday was the annual final, and it's the first final that went to a replay. The first game was a tie game over 3 weeks ago, the first tie game since 1959, and it was Kilkenny versus Galway. A lot of people wanted to see Kilkenny's dominance of the past 7 years broken. They've won 6 out of 7. They're the most dominant side. You can, you know, you talk about maybe the Pittsburgh Steelers or Dallas Cowboys in American football. You talk about New Zealand in rugby. You talk about maybe Brazil in soccer. There's absolutely no team I have ever seen that's been as dominant as this Kilkenny team. And a lot of people wanted to see Galway win. So maybe, you know, because I think we all like seeing the underdog pull one off the odd time and overcoming the odds. But they were absolutely dominant on Sunday. And I know you guys have been here in Ireland for the past couple of days. You will have seen everybody out and about, especially around Clontarf, which is about a 20-minute walk from Croke Park Stadium. And you would have seen the flags, you would have seen the bunting, you would have seen different shirts going around. And it's really a big occasion. And yet again, Kilkenny pulled it off, and they went back to Kilkenny, which is a little bit south from where you are, Kate, and they had their homecoming last night, and by all accounts, thousands of people came out. They just love hurling. They love the Irish national sport, and yet again, impressed us all.
As you say, the thousands of people come out, or a thousand people come out to celebrate the win. Are the guys that the hurlers, are they the sort of the rock stars of the country when it comes to sports? I mean, obviously you have Rory McIlroy and some others, of course, in golf and other sports. But are they known names, the hurlers?
Absolutely, but here's the thing about it. They certainly play to a professional level. They'd all get up, train maybe twice a day. They do it before they go to work in the morning. But the sport of hurling and its sister sport, which is Gaelic football, our version of football, which is a tiny bit tougher than soccer, some would say, they have day jobs too. They will play hurling. They'll be recognised in the street, but they'd be the same guy that you'd be going to the bank, the cashier behind the bank, the teacher who's teaching our kids in school, or the policeman that you see every day on the street. So there's kind of a familiarity with them. They're local heroes in the community, the 32 counties of Ireland. And they have a huge commitment, a huge level of fitness. They would be national celebrities. But at the same time, they have day jobs too, and they're regular people. So it's something that Irish people are quite proud of, the national sports, because I suppose we can all get disillusioned with sports at times, and maybe with athletes behaving badly. I know there's been certain problems with discipline in the NFL, and indeed in baseball in recent years, and certainly we obviously have soccer stars over here in Ireland too. They usually go off to play their trade in England, and sometimes behave quite badly too. But there's no airs or graces about the Gaelic footballers, because they have this amateur status. They're very much seen as part of the community, as your neighbours, but yet they do this incredible thing at the weekend where they'll play in front of 82,000 people, and the very next day we'll be back teaching your kids. So it's really a kind of unique thing, at least from our perspective in the sport.
Yeah, no kidding. Do they do the autograph thing? Because, you know, in America, that's a big deal. So you like somebody, you watch them, they're an athlete, you want their autographs. Are they kids running around with the little hurling sticks trying to get autographs and stuff?
Oh, absolutely. No, one of my own first autographs was Dublin goalkeeper back in 1994, I think it was, a Dublin hurling goalkeeper, and hurling in Dublin, the capital of Ireland, one of the most populous counties, wasn't on a particular high spot at the time. They were in the doldrums, but at the same time I was at a summer camp. A lot of kids are sent off to these summer camps during the summer to get their, when school's off, and to get them out of their parents' hair. I was sent off back in 1994 when I was, about 10 around then. I'm probably making a few people feel a bit old. But, I was sent off and I got my hurl signed. A hurl, really, to give a description to your audience, would be, it's generally made from ash, wood ash, and it would be, it would be the size of your hip, and would be really a huge block of wood with a little round top on it from which to hit the ball, which we call a slitter over here. It's an Irish word. And it's pretty fascinating. If you actually see a game of hurling, and I know you might have seen a few bits, Kate, on Sunday, it's a really vicious sport. And there's some that claim it's the fastest field sport played on grass in the world. So it's really a spectacle. And if any of you guys want to go and see a few clips on YouTube, maybe, or something like that, I've heard one of my American friends once describe it to me before, and it's like watching pretty angry farmers have a fight. Now, that's probably a little
that's perfect way to end this. Mark O'Toole, thanks so much for that description, and we'll be back with more on America Tonight.
Who won? wants to be disease-free, full of energy, and vibrant health. Two reasons you may feel constantly tired and run down could be that your body's acid level is high and your pH level is low. How does acid enter your body? A cup of coffee, a sandwich, tap water, stress, and cell phones. Plus, your own body produces acid on a regular basis. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops alkalize the water you drink and raise your pH level. They promote more oxygen in your system, higher energy potential, and many other documented health benefits. And studies show viruses, bacteria, and toxins cannot survive in an alkaline high pH environment. AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops is the least expensive and the best pH level product you can buy. Order AlkaVision Plasma pH Drops for just $29.95 at AlkaVision.com, spelled AlkaVision.com, or call 800-518-7615. That's 800-518-7615. Alkalize your body, supercharge your health with pH drops from AlkaVision.com.